Support for Science Questions comes from Apogee Instruments of Cache Valley, creating innovative sensors for measuring climate change, sustainable food production, and renewable energy. More information is at apogeeinstruments.com.
Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn. A Utah study finds more kids should have been diagnosed with autism in the 1980s. Back then, they were labeled as challenged, but new diagnostic criteria broadens the definition of the disorder and is resulting in an increase in children diagnosed with autism. It is a behavioral diagnosis based on an individual's history and demonstrated behaviors. The study reviewed data from individuals in the 1980s.
If you were to look at more recent studies that have used the newer criteria and that have used the CDC protocol, the number of folks ascertained even within a three-county area, so Salt Lake County, Utah County, Davis County, was in the thousands of records that were looked at. And that's just for 8-year-olds. Yet for this original study that I'm reporting on, this was for children, you know, up through the age of 25. And so just a marked difference in our ability to cast a broad, fine net on looking for this compared to what we were doing, you know, decades ago.
That is Dr. Deborah Builder, an adolescent and child psychiatrist at the University of Utah and co-author of the study Spectrum Disorder Reclassified. The research was published in the Journal of Autism and Developmental Disorders this month. It basically revisited 489 individuals who participated in an autism study in the 1980s. When new diagnostic criteria were applied to these individuals, 64 more were found to have an autism spectrum disorder. 305 in total would meet the criteria today out of 489 in the study.
We had realized that the way autism has been defined has undergone several changes over the past 30 years. What we wanted to do is better understand how this changing diagnostic criteria could influence the prevalence estimates. And by looking at records that were initially collected 20, 30 years ago for one of the first studies on autism prevalence in the United States, which was done here in Utah, we were able to look at how this changing diagnostic criteria could affect prevalence in the absence of the increased awareness and, you know, increased services that are available for this population.
Before moving on, let's back up to where Dr. Builder got her start in this area of research.
I chose this field of research because I participated in a program called the Utah Leadership and Education and Neurodevelopmental Disabilities Program. And having trained in pediatrics in psychiatry, there was a position open for a trainee in pediatrics the year after I finished my residency. And because I had been serving this population in a clinical setting just as a junior faculty member and they needed help in this setting, I happened to spend some of my time in this setting, I was invited to participate in this program. And this program is run through the University of Utah and through Utah State University. And over the course of a year, spending every Friday afternoon with other trainees and mentors and getting to know affected individuals and families with developmental disabilities, it really grew my interest in working with this population over time, as well as this desire within myself to affect change on a larger scale, to impact, you know, broader range of individuals beyond just my immediate practice.
She is making an impact with this new study that expands the diagnosis criteria. Dr. Builder says diagnosis of autistic disorder now requires meeting 2 out of 4 criteria under social interaction, 1 in language communication, and 1 in repetitive behaviors.
And then you need to have an additional criteria in one of those 3 areas. So an example of the social criteria would be impairments in eye contact, impairments in developing reciprocal peer relationships, being able to understand general social norms. In regards to communication, you know, there's language delay, difficulty carrying on a give-and-take conversation outside of an individual-specific area of interest, abnormalities in play, abnormalities in the way they speak, and then under repetitive behaviors, that's really where you see the criteria related to the repetitive behaviors such as hand flapping, you know, spinning in circles, or really narrow ranges of interest in which they can develop a become the world's expert on SpongeBob or some particular area which is either unusual for their age among their age group peers or unusual in the intensity of that interest.
The results and implications of the research were intriguing and far-reaching.
We found that over half of the individuals who back in the 80s were felt not to have autistic disorder, so they were not in the case group. They were looked at and felt this individual does not have autism. Over half, so 59%, actually would have met today's criteria for having an autism spectrum disorder. And I think what was also interesting is that when you look at that newly identified group that had not met criteria in the 80s, rather than this group being higher functioning than the earlier identified group, the intellectual functioning of that group was actually lower. And so that suggested a couple things. First of all, it suggested that the broadening of that criteria I was talking about also became more inclusive for individuals who also had intellectual disability rather than just individuals with normal IQ and otherwise, you know, relatively normal language development. I think that's where most of the attention has been drawn, but actually this also affected those with intellectual disability as well. So that was one interesting finding. And the second thing that it suggests, because we looked at each of the individuals who did not meet criteria back then in the 80s that we had adequate records on, what it suggests is that the folks who were high functioning back then were primarily off the radar. They weren't even really being considered for having an autism spectrum disorder as the cause of their adaptive functioning problems or social difficulties. And so it gave us a sense that back then they weren't even recognized enough to be on the spectrum to be brought into or referred to a study that was looking at the prevalence of autistic disorder.
About 1% of the U.S. population has an autistic disorder. One in every 88 children has autism, and Utah has the highest prevalence rate. The study looked at why this is so, and whether the broader definition of it accounts for the rise.
Clearly, this study shows that the broadening of criteria does contribute to the prevalence, the increased prevalence of autism, and I think that is something that has been, you know, well recognized over the last few years. I think what was helpful, though, is this was done when you were able to remove the impact of increased awareness and increased services. So nowadays, we do see a higher prevalence of measured prevalence of autism spectrum disorders. And I think part of that's broadening criteria. I think having services, particularly through the school, so having exceptionality that allows a child to receive special education services through the schools affects the ability or the willingness for folks to really recognize it. And then there's definitely more awareness. We really don't know of another clear reason why there would be an increased prevalence beyond just an increase in recognizing it, although there are some known risk factors such as increased mother's age, increased father's age, which have changed over time, but not to the degree that we're measuring the increase in prevalence.
What other risk factors are there, and does it tend to run in families?
It definitely runs in families, and the degree to which it does vary among studies, although a very recent study published over the, I believe it was within the last year, looked at the recurrence risk among siblings and found the incidence to be 17-19%. I mean, it was much higher than what had been recognized before as kind of closer to 10%. And just clinically, with my experience in working with families who have an affected individual with autism spectrum disorders, it seems more consistent with my experience as well. It seems like I work with a lot of families who have multiple affected members. So there's specific genetic disorders that do have a higher than expected rate of autism associated with it, like tuberous sclerosis, Fragile X, Down syndrome. But beyond that, there are well over 100 rare genetic variants that have been associated with autism in particular families. It's just we don't have yet one specific gene or gene combination which would explain, the large prevalence of autism spectrum disorders. When you're trying to establish prevalence on a relatively small group of kids in a disorder that is, found in 1 in 88 children, you really need to consider differences in methodology that can be leading to the outliers as far as results go.
Dr. Bilder and other researchers are still trying to determine all the causes of autism. One thing is certain, genetics can play a role.
We know this runs in families, and so I have colleagues who are working with large genetic research groups that are trying to identify genes and gene combinations that could be contributing to this. If it's related to genetics, could it be more than just what genes you have, but the effects of environment or stress or something else on those genes that affect the presentation of or the manifestation of those genes in someone's experience. But as far as like whether there's one particular thing, I think that as far as environmental causes go, if there is something out there, it has not been clearly identified yet. And there's a lot of work now, not just going on here, but also going on other states to try to find if there is something in the environment. But there really isn't anything that has been identified that accounts for the increased measured prevalence we've seen over the last decade. Nothing that will explain what we've measured. The ADOS is an examination of a child using different social type situations to get a sense for what skills or deficits they may have that relates to autism.
Okay, and at what age is it generally diagnosed, and do you start seeing signs of it?
Although about 25%, maybe 30% of children may experience a regression in their first 3 years of life where they'll have skills and then lose them in regards to their social interaction or language or social, and the remainder, it's considered really present, very, very early on, and initially, what you look for are problems in the child's ability to have a social smile where a parent or caregiver will smile at the child and the child smiles back. You look at language development. Any loss in skills, should be an immediate red flag to talk with the child's pediatrician or family practice provider. As far as diagnosis goes, in the most recent study, that was published by the CDC, the average age for autistic disorder, I think, was around 4 years of age, and it was higher for the more milder forms like Asperger's or pervasive developmental disorder, NOS. And I think that's because kids who do have higher functioning, their difficulty with social interaction or language may not become as apparent until they get older and it's clearer within their peers, their differences in their skill level and ability level.
There is evidence-based treatment, but treating autism is still challenging.
There's no medicine which treats the core features of autism. There just isn't. However, it's common in children and adults who have an autism spectrum disorder to also have another psychiatric condition, such as anxiety or depression or bipolar disorder, or like a medical condition like a sleep disturbance or a seizure disorder, that is significantly affecting their functioning and their ability to have an optimal life for themselves. And so what I'll find myself doing is spending a lot of time trying to identify what else may be going on that does have specific treatment and ensuring that treatment is initiated to improve that person's experience of the world and their ability to function as much as possible. As far as the specific behavioral concerns related to autism, beyond medication, there are behavioral treatments, and even though there are several, ABA has clearly the most data behind it. It's the most empiric evidence to demonstrate that is effective for in improving skills for children with autism spectrum disorders. And I think that's particularly for children who are caught early, and those interventions are started right within that time where your brain is primed to learn those skills anyway. So the skills for language, the skills for social interaction, catching these kids in their preschool years to really maximize their brain's ability to pick up those skills before that natural developmental window closes. There are definitely other treatment paths that folks have followed, and there are other behavioral interventions or therapies that are out there that have some evidence, but at this point in time, ABA still really has the strongest evidence out there. But, you know, a decent percentage of kids in which it's suspected are experiencing it in a manner which isn't nearly as clear-cut, whether it's because they have such a unique combination of strengths and weaknesses, so it's unclear, whether they may have other conditions that overlap with autism that makes it hard to tease through. And those folks really benefit from going to a clinic that specializes in diagnosing autism spectrum disorders, you know, such as I work at the University of Utah Autism Diagnostic Clinic, and their Dr. Farley, the psychologist I work with, Megan Farley, will do the gold standard instruments of the ADOS and ADI to determine whether an individual has an autism spectrum disorder or not. But those instruments are expensive to do because it takes a lot of time and it takes expertise, and often that degree of an intense diagnostic process is unnecessary for many kids in which the symptoms are clear, there's less confusion about what else might be going on, and it's not as confusing as far as their strengths and weaknesses. So I think it makes sense to have families start with their primary care provider, you know, potentially be referred to a psychiatrist or a psychologist
for those situations where the diagnosis is less clear. Another thing I'd really like to mention is this study was possible because individuals and their families, you know, decades ago, actively participated in this prevalence study and provided us with a lot of information, would often come in to be evaluated if it wasn't clear what their diagnosis was. And this group of families is now being recontacted so that we can also understand better the experience of autism in adulthood, how the symptoms may change or evolve, what challenges in particular does this group face, what other medical conditions or psychiatric conditions are these individuals vulnerable to. And so we have subsequently revisited with many of these families, and they have been very gracious in allowing us to speak with them again and sharing their time with us. And our research team is quite thankful for that, and we're looking forward to putting all that information together in a meaningful way so that we can impact policy, further clinicians' understanding, and just make a help create a better experience for those folks with autism spectrum disorders. I mean, even though the numbers in the adults now that are identified are much smaller than in children, these children are growing up, and they will become adults, and I think those are the numbers that we need to be looking at as we plan services and as we plan opportunities for these adults, these children who will become adults, to be as independent and as productive as possible.
That was University of Utah autism researcher Dr. Deborah Builder. For more information about autism, Dr. Builder recommends the website autismspeaks.org. Sherry Quinn, Access Utah. Stay tuned for Science Questions up next.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan, now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a two-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. I'm Megan Van Frank. This week, learn about the legendary monster lurking in the depths of Utah's Bear Lake. First, this. The Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by the Utah Humanities Council, with support from a We the People grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation.
Like the famous Loch Ness in Scotland, Utah's Bear Lake keeps a monster-sized secret in its watery depths. Located at the top of Logan Canyon on the Idaho border, Bear Lake has been at the center of monster sighting stories since at least 1868. That was the year that local resident and Deseret News correspondent Joseph Rich reported sightings of a strange serpent creature in his newspaper. Between 1868 and 1871, several more sightings of the monster were reported, including campers who claimed that an alligator-like creature emerged from the water and destroyed their camp. Local man Thomas Slight reported a huge animal out on the lake swimming with incredible speed, while Akilah Nebaker saw the monster gobbling his flock of sheep along with several rolls of barbed wire. A local fisherman even captured a junior member of the notorious Bear Lake monster family near Fishhaven in the summer of 1871. Panic over the monster reached such a fevered pitch that area gun sales increased from 1868 to 1870. But with each sighting, descriptions of the monster changed dramatically. It was reportedly between 6 and 90 feet long, with a horse-like or maybe a snake-like head, with a body that was alternately brown, green, shiny, scaly, or hairy. The monster was seen rising from the water, floating calmly, swimming at great speed, and even walking on the shore. Several eyewitnesses were well-respected members of the community, which gave the story credibility. Various plots were hatched to capture the monster, from giant fish hooks to plans for straining the lake itself. None of those came to fruition. Joseph Rich eventually admitted that he had invented the monster story to attract tourists to Bear Lake. But many eyewitnesses stood by their accounts, and Shoshone oral tradition actually tells of a serpent-like creature in the lake. So what do you think about the Bear Lake Monster? Historical fact, fascinating legend, or complete hoax? Content for this episode of the Beehive Archive was provided by the Stokes Nature Center in Logan Canyon. Sources and past episodes may be found at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of the Utah Humanities Council, I'm Megan Van Frank.
Welcome to Science Questions. I'm Sherry Quinn.
And I'm Susie Montgomery. If the Pando Aspen put out an ad in the classifieds, it would sound something like this.
Single male with strong roots, looking for fertile ground to plant my seed and grow together.
So far, Pando hasn't had many takers. Pando aspen is a clonal colony of a single male quaking aspen, Populus tremuloides, also known as the trembling giant because of its elliptical leaves that flutter in the breeze. Pando aspen grow in clones or groups of genetically identical trunks, all originating vegetatively, not sexually, from a single ancestor. This colony is located in the Fish Lake National Forest on the western edge of the Colorado Plateau in south-central Utah. And it humbly holds a couple of world records. First, the colony is collectively estimated to weigh about 6,000 tons, making it the largest known organism on the planet. And even though each tree on the surface looks like a separate individual, they are all attached by an intricate root system that stakes claim as the oldest known living organism on Earth. Some estimate from 80,000 years to a million years old. Ron Rael, a Utah State University plant ecologist, or plant ecophysiologist, illustrates the importance and urgency of protecting the Pando clone.
The Pando clone is kind of like a canary in a coal mine. In the last 100 years, it's probably reaching points where it may wink out if we don't do some fairly drastic measures here in the near future. And I think it tells us something about how we've been managing some of our landscapes, not really recognizing some of the risks that we're running. But also it's an awareness that we still have some time to do some very positive things too.
The Pando clone is important on a macro level. not only because of its size, but also because it serves as a gauge that is telling about the overall health and balance of our natural environment. The phenomena of dwindling aspen clones has a name, sudden aspen decline, or SAD. And the decline is very much underway in this famous 108-acre Utah Pando clone, due to a multitude of factors still being determined, but including wildlife management and global warming.
The term Pando is Latin for I spread.
That was Paul Rogers, who was the director of the Western Aspen Alliance.
The entire clone is a real mystery. So you can think about this differently when you walk into a forest. When you see a stem of an aspen, you say that's an aspen tree. But all of its little partners around may be exact clones of it and actually one organism. Would be different than a pine tree, where you see a stem, that's an individual. But an aspen, it could be this massive creature.
The Western Alliance came together to save the aspen.
Well, this Pando clone, for the most part, has one layer. And it's mature, and it's dying very fast now. In August, there was a report in a German newspaper about the Pando clone in Utah. In September, there was a report on the BBC Online paper. So this is not a local phenomenon. This is sort of an international icon. The Pando clone is now well known. It's also maybe not known that the Pando clone is on a stamp. So it's a national icon in that way as well. So it has a name. It has a name that's associated with Utah. And it has a name that's really associated with Aspen Sciences in general.
In fact, it is a commemoration stamp recognizing the Pando clone as one of the 40 wonders of America. Rogers and the Alliance are trying to improve communication among the ecologists who study these trees, forestry managers, and state and federal agencies.
The main focus of this alliance is to facilitate transfer of recent research to land managers. That's really where we're headed. We feel that a lot of folks are dealing with research that's a little bit out of date, but also there's a lot of new issues coming up, and we want to keep people well informed and set up a feedback loop too, so that managers can keep researchers well informed about potential situations.
And Rogers depends on one of them.
There's a scientist here at Utah State University that works on aspen genetics. Her name is Dr. Karen Mock.
The Pando clone is one genetic individual that consists of many, many individual trees. In fact, the typical state for aspen, especially in the West, in Western U.S., is to exist as a collection of many stems representing the same genotype. Sometimes it's a few stems, sometimes it's very, very many. The Pando clone happens to be one that was described, even before the advent of these genetic tools, was described morphologically. And I would be surprised if it actually is the largest clone.
Oh, okay.
No one has done a comprehensive survey looking for large clones. However, we're finding that there's much, much more clonal diversity out there than we'd ever thought before. I mean, it's really taken all of us by surprise.
Really?
So it's kind of an exciting finding.
Karen Mock is a Utah State University conservation geneticist who uses genetics to find solutions to conserving and restoring biodiversity. Her latest research is exciting because the more diverse the clone, the more evolutionary success it has. And of late, Mock has seen more diversity in the clone. But let's take a step back to really understand what's happening. In Mock's own words, she explains it like this. The Pando clone is a single genetic entity, like one tree with many branches, only the branches are trees. We don't have any evidence that there are fragments of the Pando clone on the landscape. All the trees in the Pando clone come ultimately from the same single tiny seed. It is possible that parts of the Pando have accumulated unique mutations, same as in an individual human where you have occasional mutations that arise in certain cells of the body. There is a remote possibility that some of these mutations could be beneficial, and that those trees or branches would have some kind of advantage. But there's a much bigger chance that they would have either no effect or a negative effect on fitness. That's Pando's Achilles heel. All those trees are stuck in evolutionary time since they are so genetically uniform. If it were a diverse stand of genetically different trees that were reproducing by seed, that group of trees would be able to evolve over time to track changing conditions by making new combinations of genes. However, clones do have their advantages.
It's very clear that aspen reproduces clonally as a strategy, as an ecological strategy. If you lose a single tree, you don't lose the entire clone. That's a real advantage for that genotype, right? Because if it's represented by many, many trees, then it can undergo losses in certain parts of the landscape or in certain parts of the clone, and the clone itself will persist. It really challenges, I think, ideas about individuality. That's why I love working on these kinds of problems. Because, is the tree the individual? Is the clone the individual? How long does it live? So just philosophically, it's a fun thing to work on.
Wow. So an aspen clone can speak to the human condition and even serve as a metaphor for our fear of losing our identity? Humans are typically scared of clones because, as Mach suggests, they threaten or at least profoundly confuse our idea of individuality, a very familiar topic in science fiction novels and film, and now a very controversial subject in science itself. And if we are cloned, are we still alive? This is the same issue researchers are having a hard time with in determining the age of the aspen clones.
What we wish we had for aspen is something called a molecular clock, where you could just simply say this genotype and this one are this far apart. And that distance then would have a linear relationship to time. Unfortunately, that doesn't exist. There have been several recent attempts to do some dating like that, but it's really difficult. Mm-hmm. And part of the problem is that we don't have a known standard. If we had a known age on a particular clone or a series of clones, then we would be able to figure that out. But it's a very difficult problem. And so it's hard to say what kind of ages these represent.
Because the aspen clone is in a continual state of regeneration, thousands of sprouts constantly popping up, the age of the pando clone is still undetermined.
Oh, they range all over the map. Yeah, the estimates go from, maybe a 1,000 years old to, just based on the rate of clonal spread, to maybe, one person even made an estimate of 1,000,000 years, which, is pretty far out there.
The mystery of the pando clone's true age is a big scientific challenge. Aspen species in general are exceptional in their role in our Western ecosystem.
What makes them unique is sort of a series of things, not just that they clone, because there are lots of clone plants, not just because they're a pretty tree, there are lots of those, but they do tend to be uniquely important in terms of biodiversity, especially in the West. It's one of the main deciduous trees that is present in any density in western forest. And so the aspen forests tend to support a very broad range of biodiversity. Many bird species depend on aspen, and so that makes it kind of unique.
This is the largest living organism known on Earth, and it is at risk, possibly due to climate change. But Paul Rogers and Karen Mock suggest ungulates, such as deer and elk, who feast on the young stems, are the main threat to these trees right now. To help combat the problem, ecologists and land managers have put fences around aspen colonies to help keep the hungry animals out. Still, it is not enough.
Now, there are threats to aspen, and there's recently been a phenomenon called sudden aspen decline, particularly on the Colorado Plateau, which is the Four Corner region, and in this case, particularly involving southwest Colorado, where folks thought that they were going to be declining very rapidly. I don't think that's the case, but at certain areas, and particularly at lower elevations, south-facing slopes, perhaps related to recent droughts and perhaps related to more long-term climate warming, there's certain to probably be some declines at certain elevations, those what I call marginal stands of aspen that they'll dry up essentially, and it's hard to support them over a long term. Are they declining over the whole region? I don't believe so. There may be just an increase in elevation of aspen if we go into a climate warming cycle, but I don't see that. Where there's more of an issue is at particular locations. Commonly, if we have drought situations, the large mature trees will die off and sprouts will take over, and that's, we feel like that's a pretty good cycle, and that's things die and things are born, and that's sort of how the life cycle of aspen goes along. We've been seeing a real disruption of that cycle on the things being born end, that is the sprouting of aspen. And that quickly gets into the browsing by domestic livestock and wild ungulates. And ungulates are basically hoofed animals, predominantly in this situation deer and elk. And in a lot of states in the West, deer populations are going down and elk populations are increasing. And so hence we have sort of a natural conflict between wildlife managers and vegetation or forest managers and forest ecologists. And we just need to sort of figure out a way to come together and work through these issues. And just in short, the wildlife issues quickly get into the realm of social and economic and cultural issues, i.e. hunters love to hunt. And increasingly, though there's fewer hunters, hunters that are hunting now are going after large trophy bull elk. And it takes a lot of female cow elks to support a single bull elk. And all of those elk, increasing populations, can have potentially large impacts on aspen regeneration. So you can see the story is getting more and more complicated as we talk here. Then we get into more conflict when we start talking about things like the big bad wolf.
Bill Ripple, professor of forest resources at Oregon State University in Corvallis, recently presented at the Utah State University Restoring the West Conference and has developed a widely accepted hypothesis and research on why aspens have been disappearing. He is building on the 1940s work of Aldo Leopold, the American ecologist environmentalist, who was one of the first to notice and then investigate the phenomena of the disappearing aspen groves. Leopold was highly scrutinized and reportedly ostracized for his theory on the correlation between top predators, namely wolves, with regards to aspen proliferation in Yellowstone National Park.
We found that the federal government killed off the wolves in the 1920s. So at this point, the light bulbs went off and we started writing and publishing on this theory of called trophic cascades. So that's simply saying that the disappearance of wolves affects their prey, and their prey affects the aspen trees. So the way this works is that wolves prey on elk, and elk like to eat these young shoots that are coming out of the ground, these aspen shoots. So we connected those dots and published that story as a hypothesis, and it was pretty well received. The experiment in Yellowstone continues in that the park decided to bring wolves back in 1995 and reintroduce wolves to the northern part of the park. So here we have a chance to test our theory to see, well, if it's correct, then with wolves back and them preying on elk, and since we think elk are eating the young aspen trees, could it be that with the reintroduction of this predator that aspen will again flourish? Over the last 10 years, we've been studying that response. It's amazing to see, but the aspen are now growing again in places. So it's exciting. Its restoration takes a long time, but we are starting to see aspen grow taller and taller and taller in some places. So before wolves, the aspen trees were below my knees, and they weren't able to grow above the browser's reach, which is the elk in this case. Now after wolves, there's many aspen that are above my head.
And not only do wolves reduce elk population size, but they also affect elk behavior, says Ripple. This is known as the ecology of fear.
The prey, the elk in this case, become fearful of their predator, so they change their behavior in such a way that we think the results ripple through the ecosystem. So there's two forces at play. the direct mortality from the predator, affecting densities of the prey, and this ecology of fear that we think affects the behavior of the prey. So, for example, the elk just don't stand around on streamside areas and munch on the plants all day long like they used to. They're more on the move and hiding out in deeper forests and going into the uplands. So the streamside areas are recovering. You know, wolves are controversial animals, and they're tough to live with. There's competition between big game hunters and wolves. It's very obvious.
That's where we are. We have some cultural and ecological conflicts set up. That's been a formula that's been in place a long time, and that's fine. But then when we get that ecological conflict, for example, back to this topic of the pando clone. So we have this very large clone, and now in the last couple of years, we have the mature trees dying off very quickly. The insect and disease experts that went out on the ground when I went out there about a month ago, and incidentally, this is adjacent to the Fish Lake on the Fish Lake National Forest. So there's a lot of visitors in the area. There's a campground that's within this pando clone. There's dying trees, and big dying trees next to campgrounds is dangerous, for one thing. But also, you have a lot of public around there, and so the public is very leery of active management. I mean, cutting things down, putting fences up, doing stuff like that. They don't like to see that. They want to see things in a natural state. Well, at this point, the natural state is taking over and killing a lot of old trees and perhaps killing a large part of this pando clone. So that's part one. We always have to go back to what's happening with the birth part of the formula. We have death, and so what's happening with birth? And so in the pando clone, the real threat to that area is browsing. We feel that this is near crisis state here in terms of what are we going to do about that? Are we losing the largest living organism on Earth? My colleague Karen Mock likes to say that's just the one that was discovered. It's on a road. There's a lot of people there. Somebody found this about 20 or 30 years ago. Perhaps we're losing nothing, but as far as we know, this is the largest living organism on Earth. There may be others, but we are not aware of them at this time. So that in and of itself would be a great loss, I think, for the state of Utah and for science as well, because we're learning a lot about how aspen clones function over time from that particular one because we're starting to study it more. In particular to learning about aspen, the loss of this clone could be the loss of something that's thousands of years old. So this signals, in my judgment, a failure not of an organism on Earth, but a failure of our human interactions with an organism. How do we handle and manage these things?
And ecologists stress the importance of land management, which offsets a perhaps idealistic notion that nature will take care of itself. Ron Rael, the plant ecophysiologist from Utah State University, also stresses the need to continually manage environments once they've been altered by humans.
There's a lot of natural landscapes, and we try to pretend that humans haven't had input on those, but they have, and in many cases. So in Europe, it's much more acknowledged. But they still run into the problem when human abilities to manage those landscapes don't add up anymore. The economics aren't there, the social systems perhaps aren't there. And now what do? You stop using the landscape or you change how you use it. Well, the system's perhaps not going to maintain stability. It's not going to persist, or it's not going to have sustainability. And these become real problems. And so when you have a system that humans have been heavily involved in, it's a real challenge, because what do now when your activities change and nature isn't just going to heal itself overnight?
Rael is seeing another example of this problem in his research in a much different ecosystem, the cork oak forest in central Portugal. About half the world's cork comes from these forests.
If the wine industry really shifts to screw off lids or plastic corks, it could really affect the cork industry, which again will affect these ecosystems, because the management of these systems won't, you know, really pay for itself. And so this landscape that's sort of part of Portugal's heritage is at risk. And they really have some concerns about the loss of this community, because there's a fair number of species that are linked to these landscapes, and some of them are, you know, endangered species or species of real concern.
Ironically, one of the management strategies used to manage cork oak forests is cattle grazing. But with the shrinking market of cork bottle stoppers, cattle are no longer grazing in Ryell's oak tree study area, and it is struggling to survive. The low-lying shrubs are able to thrive without the impact of grazing, and they are sapping the water and nutrients from the cork oak trees. They also increase the fire danger.
It's like getting humans out of a system doesn't make the system better. And the cork oak's a classic example. You remove humans in terms of the activities that they've done for hundreds of years, you end up with shrubs coming in, you end up then with fires, and fires completely take out your cork oak trees. And so you have a shrub community that has a high fire frequency, very different landscapes. So, you know, nothing wrong with that landscape, but it doesn't really necessarily function well for humans, and it's probably not a system that was very stable either. And, you know, we see that with cheatgrass in Utah, where cheatgrass is, you know, a fire system that has high fire return. It doesn't really provide us with a lot, and it wasn't a system that was here before. So these post-human activity systems aren't necessarily beneficial.
This is yet another instance of how once humans utilize a landscape, it does not rebound to its original state after a fallow period. An altered landscape needs continuous management, and ecologists are just as much concerned with humans and land management as they are with the natural world. In fact, there are very few environments left untouched.
Whether people, the public wants to know it or not, wildlife is managed. We manage the numbers of wildlife, particularly large game. And so that may even call into question the term wildlife. How wild are these creatures? Nonetheless, they have some control over the numbers. It's what we do. It's how we've treated those landscapes over a number of years that signals the potential demise of this enormous and age-old creature. It tells me a lot about sort of our social function, our interaction with nature. And is it a healthy thing? The way we're interacting with nature. Almost all land managers and wildlife managers I talk to would hate to see this clone lost, the pando clone, but it's representative of a much larger landscape and issues that are going on across the West involving aspen. So we have an iconic clone that's representative of many other issues. And we as scientists, professionals, land managers, for one thing, we'd hate to see ourselves be labeled as failures. Nobody wants to see that in their profession. But also, it would be an intrinsic loss to lose something like this on the landscape, and largely due to our human actions, or lack of actions, perhaps.
The Pando clone, emblems of the Rockies, are a symbol of a much larger problem. How to restore balance to an ecosystem turned unnatural by humans.
The longer we wait, the older these trees get. Just like humans, they have a little bit less output, let's say. And so they can't push as many sprouts up because they're losing energy. And many of them are dying. A dead tree cannot push up sprouts. You need that photosynthesis from above to fuel the engine below to be able to push up the sprouts. So the longer we wait, the more trouble we're in terms of trying to regenerate portions or all of this clone. And it really comes down to how much are we willing to invest in that.
For more information on aspen conservation,
they can go to our website. It's westernaspenalliance.org. And all of those words have hyphens between them. So western-aspen-and-then.org. So that's how you can find us and find out more about aspen.
Thanks for listening. Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery.
Here comes the helicopter, second time today. Everybody scatters and hopes it goes away. How many kids they've murdered, only God can say.
International politics will continue to dominate the news this weekend as Mexico takes to the polls Sunday to elect a new president. We recently saw an election of major significance take place in Greece, where Eurozone members watched nervously to see who would be called upon to stabilize one of the world's most dismal economies. In the United States, of course, the race between President Barack Obama and presumptive candidate Mitt Romney continues to heat up. But this weekend, it's Mexico's turn in the spotlight. They do things a little differently down here. First of all, the president serves only one six-year term and can never run for office again. It dates back to the 35-year regime of General Porfirio Diaz, who led the Mexican army in the rebellion against France in 1867. Mexican political history is rife with revolutionary uprisings, and like most everywhere, it is riddled with charges and countercharges of corruption. 6 years ago, it heated up white hot when Felipe Calderón defeated Andrés Manuel López Obrador by less than 1%. Obrador screamed "Pow!" and declared himself Mexico's legitimate president. His followers set up protest camps and shut down central Mexico City for 6 weeks. Obrador is running again this year as a candidate of the Party of the Democratic Revolution. The frontrunner in this election is Enrique Peña Nieto of the Institutional Revolutionary Party, which ruled the country from 1929 until 2000. Josefina Vázquez Mota is running on the National Action Party ticket. Gabriel Cadre de la Torre of the New Alliance Party is trailing far behind. The issues? Well, you know, it really is a small world, and like in the United States, the economy is on everybody's mind. So are tax cuts for the wealthy, poverty, and putting a freeze on food, oil, and electricity prices. And then, of course, there is a matter of violence along Mexico's border with the United States and how to combat the cartels. Some, like Mota, want to maintain a hardline approach, while others, like Nieto and Obrador, want to simply curb the violence between the rival factions. The thought among some politicians here is that as more and more countries move toward legalization of marijuana, which former Mexican President Vicente Fox says is inevitable, it might be a good idea to have infrastructure in place to boost the nation's economy with a fertile and plentiful cash crop. There have been debates, and there are polls, of course, much like in the U.S., and they are, as we lead up to the election, all over the place. How will it all turn out? Beats me, but I am looking forward to watching the returns on election night. This is Ed Casilia for Utah Public Radio.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.